Back at it with you on Connecticut Today, Thursday, October 15th. Reno Ferraresi joined us in the 3 o'clock hour. Reno is COO of CT Pharma. That company is the only company that produces all of the medical marijuana used by thousands of patients here in Connecticut. Governor Ned Lamont's coronavirus briefing was featured in the 4 o'clock hour. And in the 5 o'clock hour, Len Fasano joined us, the outgoing state Senate Republican leader, to talk about some issues popping up with mail-in ballots for the upcoming election. A return visit we'll have right now with Reno Ferraresi. He has now been named Chief Operating Officer, COO of CT Pharma. Now, their main facility is in Rocky Hill. They're a biotech company here in the state, but they actually specialize in cannabis, marijuana, and have a big hand in the medical marijuana procedures that go on here in Connecticut. So thought we would check back with him. Reno, Paul again here at WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, we haven't talked in a few months. Reno, first of all, congratulations on you being now the COO of CT Pharma. Talk to the folks about CT Pharma and what role you have here in what is, Reno, I guess, still kind of an evolving marijuana picture here in Connecticut.
Okay, thank you. So I was appointed president and COO. And part of my duties as the president and COO is to continue growing the company the way we have been since 2014, when we started off with a little 20,000 square foot facility in Portland. We are now in a 216,000 square foot facility in Rocky Hill, increasing our capacity tenfold from where we started off. And that's really in response to the Connecticut program that has really grown. The Department of Consumer Protection has done a tremendous job of administering the program over the past 6 years. Today, the program has 47,000 qualified patients. There are 38 qualifying conditions for adults that would make you eligible to apply for and to get a medical marijuana card, in addition to 10 pediatric conditions for patients. So the program is really coming along very nicely, and we expect to continue to see it grow until it hits roughly 2% of Connecticut's population, or around 72 to 75,000 patients at when it hits its maximum potential, probably in the next year or two.
So that's the ceiling you see, Reno, for this, that eventually working with the Consumer Protection Department and various other agencies in the state, around 70,000 or so people who may need medical marijuana will be able to get it as part of a treatment for various conditions?
That's correct, Paul. In states like Connecticut is very pharmaceutically oriented. We follow the same regulations that FDA regulated companies follow for the manufacture of over-the-counter drugs and prescription medications. So Connecticut has a very strict program in that respect. Only licensed pharmacists, for example, can dispense medical marijuana to licensed patients. So when you have a program that's that buttoned up and that well-regulated, it becomes predictable. And the Department of Consumer Protection can estimate where it's going to be. So roughly we see in other states about 2% at program maturity when you have a program similar to the one that we have here in Connecticut.
Reno, hang on. That's interesting stuff. We'll get into more of the nuts and bolts here. Reno, hang on. Reno Ferraresi, co-founder of CT Pharma. He's now the chief operating officer for a company that provides a lot of the medical marijuana that's sold here in Connecticut, with the market getting ever bigger. He said roughly over 40,000 people now in the state have medical marijuana cards, encompassing 38 different medical conditions. Think about that. More with Reno straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, 3:36. On WICC. A few more minutes with the COO of CT Pharma. They are located at a facility in Rocky Hill. Reno Ferraresi is on the phone with us. And Reno, back to our discussion about what you folks do. The medical marijuana that you are providing and growing, I would imagine that's got a lot of standards behind it, Reno, and in how you decide what to grow, when you're growing it, and the safeguards that you put behind it.
That's true. That's true. So the state mandates that every single product, every medical marijuana program that's sold in a dispensary in Connecticut and dispensed by a licensed pharmacist, each one of those products has to be registered with the Department of Consumer Protection. And each of those products also has to be third-party contract tested by a laboratory whose job it is to make sure that the product is safe and pure. They test it for the presence of, make sure there's no microbiology present, there are no heavy metals or anything that can potentially hurt a patient. And also test the product for potency. How much THC does it have? How much CBD or terpenes, for example? Those are all the different constituents that you'd find in the marijuana flower. And it's all right there on the label in Connecticut. It's required by law.
So I'm interested, Reno, whenever I speak to you or see this subject, where do you get your seeds or seedlings? How does the process begin? How do you start a plant growing in your facility? How does that work?
So there's two ways. It's a great question. So the strains that we know that are commercially viable and that we want to run all the time, let's say the equivalent of our Big Mac or our Coca-Cola formulation, those plants, we do a process, it's called cloning. We take a cutting from a mother plant, a donor plant, and we process that cutting to become a full-size plant and then flower that plant. And, you know, we get more of whatever that original starting stock was. The other way to do it, and that's considered asexual reproduction. The other way to do it is with sexual reproduction, where you take pollen and flower and you make seeds, and you can start from a seedling. The trouble with seedlings, half of the plants will become male, the other half will become female. In our industry, you just want the females because everybody wants the flower. You smoke the flower. Males just give pollen, and there's really no commercial use for that. So half of the seeds will be useful, and the other half, males, will have to be discarded. And then you need to pick the best phenotype, the best sort of all the seedlings would be the equivalent of siblings, let's say. And you want that one special sibling who really has all the attributes that a patient might be interested in, the right potency, maybe the right organoleptic or taste and smell, a lot of different criteria to consider. So usually we go with the asexual process of taking cuttings.
So it sounds like these are processes, Reno, that are just constantly going on, because I would imagine even with the medical marijuana, you have a demand that you have to keep going. You can't fall short on this stuff, correct?
That's correct. And that's why we've increased our capacity. By December, we will be at 3 times our last year's capacity. And we're really in the business of manufacturing product for patients. But CT Pharma is also heavily invested in research and development. Of course, we have our study with the Yale Medical School. We're the only cannabis company in the United States that has approval from the FDA to use our own formulations in healthy human volunteers in what's called a phase 1 investigational new drug trial. So we're very proud of that. In addition, we also have a study we're sponsoring up at the University of Connecticut with Dr. Jerry Berkowitz. We filed a provisional patent this year based on a discovery we made with his laboratory. And so really, and what we're doing with Dr. Berkowitz is evaluating commercially viable strains of cannabis to add to our collection of genetics and strains.
Obviously, we don't have recreational marijuana, Reno, in this state yet. It's probably going to be taken up by the General Assembly in the next session. But we do have your line, the medical line. The governor has signed a bill that pretty much allows people now to grow hemp, you know, without any criminal product problems there. And then you see these, and boy, Reno, I see them in shopping malls. I see them everywhere. You've got these CBD practitioners now or outlets, you know, popping up everywhere. Are these all areas that your company will be looking to get into, or are you dabbling in them right now?
So we're not. We produce products strictly for the medical marijuana program, and buyers should be aware that the regulations surrounding so hemp is legal to grow and to process from the Farm Bill that passed a couple of years ago. The United States Department of Agriculture passed that bill. But as far as processing and making products, nobody is there's no state agency or federal agency that's tasked with making sure those CBD products are pure and safe. So if you're buying something in a gas station that's a CBD product, the FDA has not regulated it, and Consumer Protection is not policing it. And you're really, you know, there's no one to make sure those products are safe and pure like the products are in the Connecticut medical marijuana program.
And finally, I know from talking to experts, and obviously this is something that you're deeply into, we are still just, Reno, I guess on the surface, or we've barely scratched the surface here, of the medical properties here and the possible benefits of marijuana and cannabis and cannabinoids and all this, correct?
That's true, Paul. Dr. Raphael Machulam in the early 1970s discovered that CBD was effective in treating children with epilepsy. And just 2 years ago, a company called GW Pharmaceuticals filed a new drug application for a drug called Epidiolex to treat Dravet syndrome and in epileptic children. And that's just one very small facet and one great example of how the medicinal properties of marijuana can be explored and developed into products that can really help humans.
Reno, thank you. Check it out online, ctpharma.com, the website ctpharma.com for CT Pharma. They produce Connecticut's medical marijuana. So if you're one of the thousands of folks who uses medical marijuana for dozens of conditions, this gentleman is responsible for what you are using, Reno Ferrarese. Reno, thank you. Be good, and we'll talk down the road. We appreciate it.
Thanks again, Paul.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Reno. Reno Ferrarese, F-E-R-R-A-R-E-S-E, Reno Ferrarese.
And today we're going to focus a little more about some of the things municipalities can do to contain the spread of the virus. What we can do is an economic bridge to the vaccine as well to help out small business and individuals. Here are the daily summary. I think a couple of things. You see another almost 16,000 tests. That's well over 100,000. Positivity rate of 1.3%. As you know, it's bouncing around a little bit. Say a month ago, we were at 1%. Last couple of days, we've been over 2%. Now we're at 1.3. I think we're at about 1.6% positivity over the last 7 days. What does that mean? That means, for example, Massachusetts is at 4% positivity. Rhode Island is at 7% positivity. These are all elevated numbers. New York gets skewed a little bit because it's such a big state. So if you're in parts of Brooklyn and Queens, you can have 7 or 8 or 9% positivity. If you're in the Adirondacks, it's a lot less. But it gives you an idea of what's going on a regional basis. Hospitalizations, plus 3, now up to 191. That's a number that all the governors I've been talking to are beginning to pay a little bit more attention to again, make sure we have the capacity there going forward. And finally, another 3 fatalities. This is a chart we're going to do on a more regular basis for you, at least every Thursday. These are sort of the alert levels that you see. We had, I'd say, 4 in the red alert, 15 or more of per 100,000 when we showed you this map about a week ago. Today it said, I think it's 11, Max has told me. You see those are in the red. I see a couple of things when I look at this map. I don't like the fact that Danbury is still on this as a red alert because we've been bringing in the cavalry there now for, 3 or 4 weeks. You know, that said, we brought down the infection level from 7 to 4%. But it's worth remembering that when COVID hits, it goes up the infection rate like a hockey stick, and it goes down a lot more gradually. I think you can see also that in Southeast Connecticut, where we've had a lot of other new additions to the red alert level, They are in a region. You know, we had seen from Danbury that we could contain this on a just municipal basis. But we also know that it also can have some regional spread. Another thing that we're following very carefully. So I'm sure this is a real eye exam for you. I can't even see the names. But what I will tell you is that we'll get this out to you in a clearer way on our website, be able to see where your town is on the red, yellow, and orange alert. And let me tell you what that means on the next chart. This is something that Deirdre and Josh have worked together really well. You know, on the yellow, which is 5 to 9 cases, let's say we're at about 8 cases per 100,000 here as a state overall. I think that is sort of a steady as you go, maintain your vigilance. Orange, which is, 10 to 14 cases per 100,000. There we have a few more. There we're dealing not just with the local health departments, but Deirdre and her team at Public Health will be reaching out to the local officials. We're doing this already, but ramping it up going forward. You know, let's say limit the size of your groups. Be more careful, because orange could lead to red, as you've seen over the last couple of weeks. You know, pre-K through 12 schools, be careful there. Continue to try and maximize your spacing, mask wearing, ventilation. We're going to prioritize that. Hopefully you can keep the in-classroom learning going, but that's the extra attention we need. I should tell you that we've gone from about 33 to 40% of our K through 8 schools are now open on a full-time basis. So that's just a reminder what's going on broadly in the state in terms of allowing kids to get back to school, mainly moving from hybrid to full-time. Finally, in the red alert section, it's just worth seeing. There you are, well over 15 cases. We've got a number of communities there. These are our recommendations. These are not mandates, but our recommendations are certainly to, for example, postpone indoor activities, including some of the sports that would be indoors. Work in collaboration with your local health department when it comes to schools. Maybe time to start thinking about more remote learning in a situation like that. And as we talked about the other day, if you're in that red alert category, you could see those on the map. We're giving the local mayor's discretion to not move to phase three, to stay at phase two or revert back to stay phase two. So not 75% in restaurants, but 50% in restaurants. That's at local discretion. Please notify us in an extra 3 or 4 days where you plan to be in that mix. But I think the red alert level, these are ways we're trying to highlight some of the risks you've got there. And Deirdre will be in a strong position to tell you, what our thinking was behind these as needed. I did want to say that these are things the town can do to try and mitigate the spread, to try and contain the spread, as we see flare-ups around the state and even bigger around the entire region. We're not like Wisconsin with a 22% infection rate, but we do have areas that have 5, 6, 7% infection rates, and there we want to try and contain that as best we can. In the meantime, we ought to be thinking as well about what we can do for our small business and individuals, because while, we've got 99% of our economy is open, as you know, the service sector has been slower to be able to get back on their feet. There are a number of groups that aren't going as all. We've got theaters, not-for-profits, and others. And what can we do to help them in the meantime? Obviously, we had hoped that we'd see the federal government step up by now. They haven't. So we have a couple of strategies in place that we'll be able to roll out in more detail. You've heard from the Department of Housing. We upped the amount of rental assistance from $20 to $40 million. There, we're negotiating that between landlord and tenant to allow you to stay in your home, stay in your apartment longer without risk of eviction, no eviction. You know, we thought long and hard about the not-for-profits who have been doing heroic work for us throughout this entire pandemic, providing what support we can. Melissa McCaw over at OPM, she's dispersed a lot of the $120 million out of our COVID relief money to go to those not-for-profits, and social services, and housing and addiction and ways that we can provide you the support you need to make up for some of the COVID-related expenses that have hit you. And that money is going out the door now. Most of it has been dispersed. You know, thirdly, David Lehman and Glendalyn over at DECD, we did well with the Paycheck Protection Program, keeping people in place, keeping their jobs going. But that money has run out. We had a bridge loan program for a while. That burnt up pretty fast. So David is going to be rolling out next week, the next iteration of a grant program, not a loan program. Keep it simple. This is going to be $50 million. That's going to be focused on small businesses, those with 1 to 20 employees, those that have taken a real hit in terms of, COVID revenues shortfall. You know, half of that going to distressed municipalities, making sure those smallest companies, maybe not as easy for them to access all the PPP. We are making that available. It's going to be available as a grant. We're going to get that out the door over the course of the next 60 days and make that available to all of our small businesses we can within those categories. More details than that to come. And that's also going to be available not just for small businesses, but also not-for-profits. We'll be doing something bigger for the event venues that have been put off, but other not-for-profits, in addition to the COVID relief money we've got going for you, in addition, some of these grant monies will be there. And finally, that takes me back to the program I'm most enthusiastic about, to be blunt, and that's called Shared Work. We've talked about that in the past. I just want to remind you it's available. It's available now, and take credit for it. Take advantage of it. And we have a lot of resources. Nobody will be turned away that is so deserving. So if you're in a small business and you're just trying to think right now, boy, I'd like to be able to keep Bob, Mary, and Jose on, but I can't afford all three of them. I'm gonna have to lay two of them off. That's not the choice you have to make anymore. If you can only afford to keep them on board for 50% of their time, keep them on board for 50%. Shared work will pay for the other 50%. So it's as opposed to unemployment insurance, to me, this is like employment insurance. And I just think it's invaluable. It's invaluable for small businesses and larger businesses. It's available for not-for-profits. Again, not-for-profits, take advantage of this. It's a way to keep people employed. You can't afford their full salary. You can afford part of their salary. So as our economy slowly gets back in the gear, you'll have people already in place, working part-time, ready to go full-time. And you can access this, sharedworkct.com, sharedworkct.com. Let's see the video, Max.
It happens to every business. A bump in the road. Maybe demand for your product or services goes down. The market goes in the tank. You don't want to lay off staff. They're like family. But what else can you do? The answer? The Connecticut Department of Labor's Shared Work Program. The Shared Work Program saves employers money and employees jobs. Here's how it works. Instead of cutting jobs, you cut hours. Then employees can collect partial unemployment benefits for the hours they've lost. Say an employee's hours are cut temporarily by 50%. In addition to a partial paycheck, the worker will get 50% of his or her regular weekly unemployment benefit. In other words, employers save payroll and hang on to their skilled workforce, while employees keep their jobs and collect unemployment for the hours lost. Don't think of the Shared Work Program as unemployment insurance. Rather, it's employment insurance, a safety net. This is a program that keeps workers employed. This is a program that shows employees that you care. The Shared Work Program protects your business during slow times. Connecticut's Shared Work Program. It saves money. It saves jobs. Plain and simple, it's working downturns into upturns.
Exactly. Making lemonade out of lemons. And this is what the Shared Work Program does. I got to say, special thanks to the folks from Franklin Products in Torrington. David and I were there today. They made seat cushions for airlines. And let's face it, airlines are not flying as much these days. That business was really slowing up. They were forced to start laying off people. And they've really been entrepreneurial. A, they're taking advantage of the shared work program. And B, they're starting to make masks and gowns right here in anticipation of what we may need in terms of COVID. And finally, just a reminder that all these programs to mitigate the effects, slow the spread in our municipalities, help our businesses get back on their feet. The therapies you heard Dr. Koh talk about on Tuesday, this is all part of our bridge to get to that vaccine. I can't tell you when it's going to be here. It's not going to be here as soon as some of the political promises, but it should be available by sometime in the first quarter, half of next year. And Deirdre Gifford has put together the advisory group. We've announced who those people are. She's going to get the preliminary draft of our recommendations out to CDC. I think it's tomorrow is their requirement. We'll be talking, looking at best practices from all the other states going forward. The vaccination will happen in a couple of phases. We're thinking about the critical workforce, otherwise known as the essential workers. We want to make sure they're vaccinated, feel safe getting being able to be at work. And those high-risk individuals, those who are most vulnerable, those will be some of the priorities we have. Slow down. I know that we don't have a vaccine yet, and that still is going to be 2, 3, 4 months away, depending on the progress they have with the clinical trials. But we are beginning to make some progress right now. And Deirdre will be happy to tell a little more about our thoughts in the advisory group. And the advisory group is also there to opine not just on the vaccine itself, but how we can convince people that they can take this vaccine safely. With that, Max, any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Good afternoon. First question, where do you stand on the travel advisory now that there are 36 states on the list and New Jersey and Massachusetts are getting close to the benchmark and Connecticut has been bouncing around as well with numbers? Are there any specific changes being considered?
I think so. It'd be a little ironic if we were on our own quarantine list. It does make sense. Look, we're talking about three quarters of the states out there. I'm thinking I got to, you know, work with Deirdre and Josh on this, that perhaps at some point we just say you get tested before you fly into Connecticut. You quarantine when you come here. I think maybe we start treating all these states as one. It's getting a little complicated who's in and who's out week in and week out.
And what are you hoping to discuss at tonight's COVID vaccine advisory group meeting?
Did you hear that, Deirdre? The COVID vaccine advisory meeting date?
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. So tonight's meeting will be an introduction for the most part. We're going to let the advisory group members know some of the framework that the governor was just discussing. We'll discuss at a high level the contents of our initial draft plan that's going to CDC tomorrow, get their feedback or thoughts on that so that they can be incorporated into subsequent iterations of the plan, and then just talk about overall goals and the structure for the subcommittees as well.
Thank you.
News 8. NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. I know earlier, you know, we had talked about how you wanted to focus some more on certain communities, been talking about, you know, rolling back to phase two. I guess just first off, have you heard from some communities that do want to do that? Because we've heard from a couple that have said that they don't think the idea is workable.
Yeah, Matt, for the group that was from the category that we first introduced Tuesday or last week, I think I'm told that Wyndham is interested in rolling back. I'm told that Norwich and New London may want to pause before they roll back to phase two. So they're exercising their discretion.
And when you announced that, I guess it was a few days ago now, or almost a week ago, we had talked about how you had initially wanted things to be more on a statewide basis. But now where we have these 11 towns that are in this red alert, it seems like you're really trying to focus in on certain towns and certain communities. Can you kind of explain a little bit more about your shift in thinking and also kind of what is the message kind of directly to the people and the leaders in those communities right now?
Yeah, I would say 6 months ago when we said let's work on a statewide basis, I didn't want some communities saying my bars can be open and others not. We wanted to have a cap in terms of permissiveness. We wanted to be fairly strict broadly across the board. Now as we're opening up, we're on the inverse of that calculation. So we're allowing states, municipalities to open up, based upon the statewide metrics. But if those municipalities don't feel comfortable, want to be a little more aggressive in terms of what they think could potentially mitigate the spread, we allow them to tamp down. We're never allowing some to open up widely and others not, but we are allowing others to be more strict if they want to be.
And what about the people, I guess, who live in some of these communities? Because a lot of these ideas seem like a personal plea for people to change their behaviors.
It is. I mean, that's why we have an alert. That's why Deirdre sends a text alert out to people in these communities that are yellow or in particular red. We want to highlight that your behavior makes a big difference. You know, more than going from 50 to 75% in some facility or another, it's your behavior that makes the big difference. And that's what we're trying to emphasize.
Okay, thank you.
Good, Paul. I'm as shocked as you are.
Come on, Len. It's
oh, my.
My account got hacked. That's what I'm going to use, Len, from now on. My Twitter account got hacked. Jeez.
And believe it or not, he thought people would believe it.
Well, that's the thing. Len, what's that old thing, that old phrase? What do you think? We just fell off the turnip truck? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Len, I'll update this.
I was born at night, but it wasn't last night.
That's yeah, and the dog ate my homework. Yeah. Len, I know you're concerned here with a couple of things, and you've been updating us on you're kind of watching the Secretary of the State's office in this massive thing of getting all the ballots out to people and getting them back in and kind of this let them eat cake kind of attitude by Denise Merrill's office. And I know there are now some problems with a couple of municipalities, and you voiced your concern. What's going on here?
So I said a long time ago when she did the primary and she did the ballots and there was that mess up, I said we couldn't handle it. She did it anyway. I told her I don't think she should do it. When she asked my opinion, I told her I think that was a mistake. So then when she did with the election coming up in November, she said, you know what? I'm going to send out all the applications, but all the ballots are going to go back to town halls, and the town halls have to deal with it. And I said way back when, and I sent her a letter, that is not right, because what you're saying is all the problems are going to become the town clerk. So if there are problems, it's going to be theirs, not mine. I'm squeaky clean, and they have to deal with it. And that's exactly what happened, Paul. Every time there's a problem in an election with this Secretary of State, it's not her. No matter what it is, running out of ballots in Bridgeport, it's not her. Closing, having a poll stay open late because there's a follow-up with the machine, it's not her. 6,000 ballots going off different directions, it's not her. So every time it's not her. And what I wrote to her today and said was, listen, your job is you're the Secretary of State. And your job is to make sure elections go smoothly.
Yeah.
Don't point fingers. Use the power of your office. Use the resources you have in your office. And make sure that these towns, for whoever messed it up, you get it corrected. Send people down there if they need help. Don't sit back and say, oh, my gosh, they're all incompetent, which is what one of our spokesmen said, which I find very hard to believe that spokesman gets away with that. Mm-hmm. She should say, look, there's a problem. We'll point fingers later, but we need to fix this and get people's right to vote corrected. That's what we should be doing. That's what a stand-up person does, and that's what a constitutional officer should do.
Now, I guess, Len, we have problems. Wallingford and Vernon were the two towns where there have been, correct me if I'm wrong, but are those the two?
Wallingford, Vernon, New Haven, and I believe there are other towns as well that we just don't know about yet. And it was a clerk who picked it up. I don't know which one. but it wasn't even the Secretary of State who picked it up.
And they picked up what exact problem here? Not enough ballots or bad mailing lists? What are we looking at here? Do we know?
So, yeah, so if you send in an application for an absentee ballot, they sent you back a ballot. And if your candidate in the rep seat, representative seat, or the senatorial seat split that district up, the ballot you received may not reflect the right people on the ballot. Now, there are other factors that go into it, so it does limit that world a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's essentially what happened. And it's a computer-driven error that is confusing, but it was a computer-driven error. But they can identify who these people are, and that's where the Secretary of State should work with the town clerk's office, calling those people and figuring out how to get them the right ballot securely. That's all it's going to take, but don't complain about it. Don't use war of words. Just get the job done.
Yeah, fix it. I mean, it's not, you know, and you know what, Len? You've been around long enough to know, and so have I, that if a public employee or if a constitutional officer or somebody in government says, look, this happened, we're going to get on it right away, and it's going to get fixed, they look better in the end. Most people say, hey, that's how they have to do their job, right?
Exactly. Look, things don't go smoothly no matter what you do in life. And problems erupt, and especially when you're, as I said a thousand times now, that you're taking a, you know, George Jetson type of approach to ballot to exercising your rights to vote in a Fred Flintstone system. You're going to have problems that are going to erupt on this. And people get that. But then be a stand-up constitutional officer and say, problems erupt. I don't care whose fault it is. It doesn't matter. Let me go in there. Be the adult in the room and fix it. Instead of saying, wasn't me, it was them, they're incompetent. Who cares?
Yeah,
we need confidence in the system, and we got to make sure. And if she believes that all votes matters, which is what she says, and we need to count all the votes, which we all can agree on, then don't stand back, get involved, get in the fray. Now, I understand in some cases she has, in some she hasn't, but that's not good enough for me. You get in all the frays, whether you like that town or not, whether it's a Republican town or not, it doesn't matter. Just do your job.
Good thoughts. Len, thank you. Len Fasano, be good. We'll talk down the road. Be good, Len. Thanks. Stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. There you go, folks. So you folks, heads up in case there's any discrepancies in New Haven, Wallingford, Vernon, some other towns. So, you know, make sure you get your ballot. Make sure the names match. Make sure the candidates on the ballot are the ones for your proper district, especially the legislative districts. Because how many times have we seen in the state house and state senate districts, you know, how especially we've had that in Milford, we've had that in Stratford, and Sonia, where you have legislative races decided by 15, 20, 80, 100 votes.